The NBA playoffs are here, and with FanDuel, your group chat's about to be going off. Because right now, new customers can bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets if you win. And with live bets, your heart emojis will really be racing from tip-off to the final buzzer. Plus, when you win, you'll get paid faster than your friends can send you a victory gift. Or is it GIF? Who cares? You won! So get the word out to your crew and download FanDuel today. New customers bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets if you win. Make every moment more with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Official partner of the NBA.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Like this podcast? Please rate and review us. Don't want to miss an episode? Please subscribe.
This is Washington Today for Monday, May 18th. I'm Steve Scully. As a number of states gradually reopen in advance of the upcoming Memorial Day weekend, the death toll here in the U.S. from coronavirus has exceeded 90,000. And the CDC says it expects to reach 100,000 by early next month. More than 1.5 billion cases here in the U.S., more than in any other country around the world. There is some promising news on a vaccine that appears to be safe and able to stimulate an immune response against the virus. Moderna is the manufacturer of this potential breakthrough. The findings are based on results from the 8 people who had received 2 doses of the experimental vaccine beginning back in March. That news sending the stock market up, gaining more than 900 points today on the Dow. We'll have the latest on coronavirus and the story shaping Washington Today. It's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin at the White House, where the president revealing that he's been taking hydroxychloroquine, that controversial drug that's been championed as a potential treatment for coronavirus, despite limited evidence from the medical community. The president saying that he consulted with the White House doctor about taking the drug, but it was not recommended for him. Nevertheless, he is doing so. More from the president.
The frontline workers, many, many are taking it. I happen to be taking it.
Hydroxychloroquine?
I'm taking it. Hydroxychloroquine. Right now, yeah. A couple of weeks ago, I started taking it. Because I think it's good. I've heard a lot of good stories. And if it's not good, I'll tell you right, I'm not going to get hurt by it. It's been around for 40 years for malaria, for lupus, for other things. I take it. Frontline workers take it. A lot of doctors take it. I take it. No, I hope to not be able to take it soon because, you know, I hope they come up with some answer. But I think people should be allowed to. I got a letter from a doctor the other day from Westchester, New York, around the area. He didn't want anything. He just said, sir, I have hundreds of patients and I give them hydroxychloroquine. I give them the Z-Pak, which is zithromycin, and I give them zinc. And out of the hundreds of patients, many hundreds, over 300 patients, I haven't lost one. He said, please keep pressing that, sir. And if you look at that phony report that was put in, that report on the hydroxy was given to people that were in extraordinarily bad condition. Extraordinarily bad. People that were dying. No, I think for whatever it's worth, I take it. I would have told you that 3-4 days ago, but we never had a chance because you never asked me the question.
Did the White House doctor recommend that you take that? Is that why you're taking it?
Yeah, White House doctor. Didn't recommend. No, I asked him, what do you think? He said, well, if you'd like it. I said, yeah, I'd like it. I'd like to take it. A lot of people are taking it. A lot of frontline workers are taking hydroxychloroquine. I don't take it because, hey, people said, oh, maybe he owns the company. No, I don't own the company. You know what? I want the people of this nation to feel good. I don't want them being sick. And there's a very good chance that this has an impact, especially early on. But you look at frontline workers, you look at doctors and nurses, a lot of them are taking it.
That news from the president earlier today at the White House. And during a virtual summit with members of the World Health Organization, the Geneva-based organization announcing there will be an independent review of how the WHO responded initially to this pandemic. As you know, the Trump administration has suspended U.S. aid because of what it claims are close ties to China. And Chinese President Xi Jinping saying that his country has pledged $2 billion for the WHO. Of course, China continues to face world condemnation for what many claim was either an early cover-up or missteps to the extent of the virus as it originated in Wuhan, China. Through a translator, here is the Chinese president.
The virus does not respect borders, nor is race or nationality relevant in the face of the disease. Confronted by the ravages of COVID-19, the international community has not flinched. The people of all countries have tackled the virus head-on. Around the world, people have looked out for each other and pulled together as one. With love and compassion, we have forged extraordinary synergy in the fight against COVID-19. In China, after making painstaking efforts and enormous sacrifice, we have turned the tide on the virus and protected the life and health of our people. All along, we have acted with openness, transparency, and responsibility. We have provided information to the WHO and the relevant countries in the most timely fashion. We have released the genome sequence at the earliest possible time. We have shared control and treatment experience with the world without reservation. We have done everything in our power to support and assist countries in need.
The Chinese leader coming to defense of his country, but the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Alex Azar, critical of the World Health Organization during this two-day virtual assembly, as the Chinese president appearing to express his support for that independent investigation into the pandemic. Appearing by video link, the HHS secretary criticized the WHO's failure during the outbreak, telling officials there that it cost many lives in the U.S. and around the world.
We must be frank about one of the primary reasons this outbreak spun out of control. There was a failure by this organization to obtain the information that the world needed, and that failure cost many lives. The United States welcomes the assistance provided by our friends during this crisis, and we have been proud to allocate over $9 billion that will benefit the global COVID-19 response, including more than $500 million in planned investments by my ministry to support more than 40 of the most at-risk countries. The United States launched the first human vaccine trial and reported the first positive results from a therapeutic clinical trial. These successes and the transparent way in which we share them will benefit the whole world. WHO's operations must be transparent too, and we support an independent review of every aspect of WHO's response to the pandemic. We all must come together to ensure that WHO fulfills its key mandate and that member states comply with the international health regulations. In an apparent attempt to conceal this outbreak, at least one member state made a mockery of their transparency obligations with tremendous cost for the entire world. We saw that WHO failed at its core mission of information sharing and transparency when member states do not act in good faith. This cannot ever happen again. The status quo is intolerable. WHO must change, and it must become far more transparent and far more accountable.
And of course, that member state, a reference to China, and those comments by the Secretary of Health and Human Services during this two-day virtual conference with members of the World Health Organization. We'll have more on coronavirus later in the program, but now to the Justice Department, where Attorney General Bill Barr today confirmed that the DOJ uncovered evidence that indicates a connection between al-Qaeda and the shooting at that Pensacola Naval Air Station last year. The Saudi military officer who had been training with Navy personnel, Mohammed al-Shamrani, as a significant tie to the terrorist organization in the Arabian Peninsula. He may have been radicalized as far back as 2015, according to officials. The shooting took place last December the 6th. 3 sailors were killed, 8 others injured. This new information came from the gunman's cell phone. More with the Attorney General.
Today, I am pleased to announce that thanks to the relentless efforts and ingenuity of FBI technicians, the FBI finally succeeded in unlocking al-Shamrani's phones. The phones contained information previously unknown to us that definitively establishes al-Shamrani's significant ties to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, not only before the attack, but before he even arrived in the United States. We now have a clearer understanding of al-Shamrani's associations and activities in the years, months, and days leading up to his attack. Indeed, the information from the phones has already proved invaluable in protecting the American people. A counterterrorism operation targeting AQAP operative Abdullah al-Maliki, one of al-Shamrani's overseas associates, was recently conducted in Yemen. We will not hesitate to act against those who harm Americans. I would now like to turn the podium over to Director Wray, who will provide further information and an update on the FBI's investigation.
That from the Attorney General, who joined the FBI Director Chris Wray. Both of them admonished Apple for not assisting the federal government in unlocking the phones, even though authorities obtained search warrants for their contents following the shooting of December of last year. Trump administration officials, including the president, speaking to Apple months ago, asking them to assist law enforcement officials to unlock the phones. Apple has maintained it would not provide a backdoor for law enforcement to access the privacy on those phones. The company did say it provided iCloud backups, account information, and transaction data as requested by the DOJ. More from today's news conference, now with the FBI Director, Chris Wray.
We're here today because of a tragic reminder of just how grave, how imminent the terrorism threat still is. An al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula associate's murder of three people and wounding of eight others right here in America. As the Attorney General described, through a combination of skill and determination, the men and women of the FBI have succeeded in accessing the terrorist's two phones, both of which he tried to destroy. Our investigation into December's terror attack in Pensacola continues, so there are limits on what I can say today, but this is an important moment. An important case. It's important because what accessing the evidence of this killer's phone allows us to do to protect the American people. In just a short time, we finally access that evidence. We and our partners have already put it to good use. Among other steps we've taken, just a moment ago, you heard the Attorney General describe the recent counterterrorism operation targeting Abdullah al-Maliki, one of the overseas AQAP operatives that al-Shamrani associated with while here in the United States. It's also important because it underlines just how serious our fight against terrorism is and how vital it is for the FBI to maintain its unflagging vigilance against the threat. The evidence we've been able to develop from the killer's devices shows that the Pensacola attack was actually the brutal culmination of years of planning and preparation by a longtime AQAP associate. The new evidence shows that al-Shamrani had radicalized not after training here in the United States, but at least as far back as 2015, and that he had been connecting and associating with a number of dangerous AQAP operatives ever since. It shows that al-Shamrani described a desire to learn about flying years ago. Around the same time, he talked about attending the Saudi Air Force Academy in order to carry out what he called a special operation. And he then pressed his plans forward, joining the Air Force and bringing his plot here to America.
A follow-up from the FBI director on that shooting that took place at the Pensacola Naval Air Station in Florida back in December of last year. And also today, the Attorney General saying that he does not expect a criminal investigation of former President Barack Obama or former Vice President Joe Biden, the presumptive 2020 Democratic presidential nominee. President Trump has suggested that Obama administration officials were involved in criminal wrongdoing in connection with the FBI's investigation into Russia interference. More from today's Justice Department news conference.
Pete, I'm not going to comment on what the president or Vice President Biden, for that matter, say in connection with their campaigns, but I will address the role of the Department of Justice. I think, as you know, I've commented since I have been Attorney General and even during my confirmation hearings that over the past few decades, There have been increasing attempts to use the criminal justice system as a political weapon. The legal tactic has been to gin up allegations of criminality by one's political opponents based on the flimsiest of legal theories. This is not a good development. This is not good for our political life, and it's not good for the criminal justice system. And as long as I'm Attorney General, the criminal justice system will not be used for partisan political ends. And this is especially true for the upcoming elections in November. We live in a very divided country right now, and I think that it is critical that we have an election where the American people are allowed to make a decision, a choice, between President Trump and Vice President Biden based on a robust debate of policy issues. And we cannot allow this process to be hijacked by efforts to drum up criminal investigations of either candidate. And I'm committed that this election will be conducted without this kind of interference. Any effort to pursue an investigation of either candidate has to be approved by me. Now, what happened to the president, and I've said this many times, what happened to the president in the 2016 election and throughout the first 2 years of his administration was abhorrent. It was a grave injustice, and it was unprecedented in American history. The law enforcement and intelligence apparatus of this country were involved in advancing a false and utterly baseless Russian collusion narrative against the president. The proper investigative and prosecutive standards of the Department of Justice were abused, in my view, in order to reach a particular result. We saw two different standards of justice emerge, one that applied to President Trump and his associates, and the other that applied to everybody else. We can't allow this ever to happen again.
That from William Barr, the Attorney General here in Washington, and the President of the White House saying he was surprised by that statement. By the way, news on Capitol Hill that Senator Marco Rubio will temporarily serve as the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. That announcement from Republican leader Mitch McConnell, the Florida Republican's appointment as the interim chair, follows news last week that Senator Richard Burr was going to step down as he faces an FBI investigation into allegations of inside stock trading. At CBSNews.com, a follow-up on last night's 60 Minutes program. Quote, Jerome Powell shook Washington, Wall Street, and the world this past week when he warned that the pandemic's crisis threatens lasting damage to Americans' prosperity. As the chair of the Federal Reserve, Powell is among the most powerful people in the economy. He acted swiftly in the sharpest collapse since the Great Depression, but he fears Congress's initial $3 trillion bailout won't be enough to save a generation from low growth and stagnant incomes. The full story is available at CBSNews.com. Here's a portion of that interview with Scott Pelley.
If the economy reopens and the infection rate surges, what then?
The government would have to reintroduce these social distancing measures and that you would have another downturn, and that would be bad for confidence. So that's a risk we really want to avoid. You know, the virus hasn't gone away. The reason that, cases have gone down and are declining is because people have been in their homes and not in their businesses and not out among crowds.
Powell told us the economy will shrink dramatically in the second quarter, April, May, and June, at an annualized rate of around 30%. This past week, the Labor Department reported a total of more than 35 million Americans had lost their jobs so far. The unemployment rate will be historic.
And your people are projecting what, 20%, 25%?
There are a range of perspectives, but those numbers sound about right for what the peak may be.
25% is the estimated height of unemployment during the Great Depression. Do you think history will look back on this time and call this the second Great Depression?
No, I don't. I don't think that's a likely outcome at all. We had a very healthy economy 2 months ago. Our financial system is strong. You have governments around the world and central banks around the world responding with great force and very quickly and staying at it. So I think all of those things point to what will be a, it's going to be a very sharp downturn. It should be a much shorter downturn than you would associate with the 1930s.
You expect the third quarter to see growth.
It's a reasonable expectation that there'll be growth in the second half of the year. I would say, though, we're not going to get back to where we were quickly. We won't get back to where we were by the end of the year. That's unlikely to happen.
In terms of the workforce, Mr. Chairman, who is getting hurt the worst by this downturn?
The people who are getting hurt the worst are the most recently hired, the lowest paid people. It's women to an extraordinary extent. Of the people who were working in February, who were making less than $40,000 per year, almost 40%, have lost their jobs in the last month or so.
Just a portion of the interview with the Fed Chair, Jerome Powell, on CBS's 60 Minutes. It's available online at cbsnews.com. But at the White House today, economic advisor Kevin Hassett indicating that a future stimulus package may not be needed to address the economic damage caused by coronavirus and the pandemic across the country. The Trump administration essentially taking a wait-and-see approach, measuring economic indicators and the current stimulus bill before proceeding with any additional aid.
Kevin, can you weigh in on the assessment of the economy that we heard from Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell? He said, yes, it is possible unemployment could reach 25%. He also said, though, the recovery will be more robust and more happening.
Yeah, Jay is, a real student of the economy. That's why the president chose him to be Fed Chair. And, you know, I care a lot what he and his staff of how many hundreds of economists think. I think that most economists agree that the near-term outlook is very similar to what the CBO is saying, which is that you're going to have a second quarter that's one of the worst quarters we've ever seen, and then a fourth quarter and a third quarter that are a lot better. Very strong second half of the year. And the way to think about it is that if in the second quarter people just stop, then in the third quarter people start moving again, then the third quarter just necessarily has to be higher than the second quarter, so you should see positive growth. The question is, how long does it take to get back to peak? You know, how long does it take us to get back to where we were in January? And I think that that's an open question. Economists have a lot of different views. And it's really going to depend on how quickly we get...
Is that likely?
Oh, 25%. Yeah, if you add the initial claims that we've already seen to the unemployment rate from last time, then you do get an unemployment rate north of 20.
Kevin Hassett, White House economic advisor, meeting with reporters on the North Lawn earlier today. Last Friday, of course, we carried it live on C-SPAN. House Democrats passing another $3 trillion in assistance, including money to states facing a huge shortfall in tax revenues. That bill has been described as dead on arrival in the Republican-controlled Senate. At the closing bell, the Dow made some huge gains, jumping 912 points. The Nasdaq rose 220, and the S&P was up 90. Meanwhile, at a Senate hearing tomorrow, the Federal Reserve Chair is expected to again state that the Fed will use whatever tools it takes to keep the markets functioning and get money to those businesses who need it the most during this pandemic. We will have live coverage of the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs on the C-SPAN networks. Meanwhile, if there is another round of congressional stimulus, the Trump administration indicated that they will not approach any further negotiations with Democrats until next month at the earliest. The president spending part of the day meeting with restaurant and industry executives. More from the White House.
Well, I think so. And you're seeing it maybe today for the first time where not only are the markets up tremendously, but yes, we've had tremendously good and positive information on therapeutics, on cures, and on vaccines.
Yes, sir.
From some of the most respected companies in the world and researchers and doctors and labs. And that's coming in, and I think you're very close to having a very, very positive situation. And, with it understood, and we always talk about it, Tim, when you lose one person to this, it's too many, just
yes,
too many.
Yeah.
And we're talking about thousands and millions of people throughout the world on something that should have never happened.
Absolutely.
Should have been stopped in China, should have been stopped at the source. But it happened. But they're coming out with tremendous, it's incredible what they can do. And I've seen results.
Absolutely.
And the results are staggeringly good. So I'm very happy. And the market's up very big. And I think you're going to have a V. I think it's going to be terrific. I think we're going to have a transition in the third quarter, Ben. Mm-hmm. and the transition is going to lead to a really good fourth quarter. And I think we're going to have a year next year because of all the stimulus and everything else and the pent-up demand like you haven't seen in a long time.
2021 is going to be amazing.
And the stock market's not very short of where it was with all that we went through. And that means a lot of smart people are looking and they're saying, we're coming back and we're coming back to that level. I think we're going to come back to greater than that level. And we've learned a lot. One of the things we've learned is be reliant on ourselves. Don't be reliant on other countries that, frankly, maybe have different agendas. And frankly, there are plenty of them out there. So it's one of those things. So this is a very big day. This feels much different than Friday. Friday is a different feeling than today. This is a very positive day.
That's from the president. And, of course, there is positive news. This is the headline from the New York Times. Moderna coronavirus vaccine trials showing promising early results. The company announcing today its preliminary test in 8 healthy volunteers was safe. It is now on an accelerated timetable to begin a larger human trial. More details at nytimes.com. And now to Capitol Hill, where Senate Republicans are preparing for another week of nomination votes in advance of a Memorial Day recess next week. The House is out of town this week, though it's expected to return next Wednesday to take up a number of Senate-passed bills that would reauthorize provisions for the USA Freedom Act and also some changes to the court created by FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And on the Senate floor, another round of finger-pointing on which chamber is doing a better job. Here is Republican leader Mitch McConnell.
Mr. President, we've done more for the American people in 2 weeks on this side of the Capitol than the House of Representatives has done in the last 2 months. In the 2 months that House Democrats spent away from their duty stations, they seemingly gave themselves just one assignment: draft an enormous political messaging bill and brand it as coronavirus relief. But even on this basis, they failed. The 1,800-page doorstop that Speaker Pelosi dropped last week was appropriately greeted as the legislative equivalent of a stand-up comedy. There were tax hikes on small businesses in the midst of a small business crisis. There were targeted tax cuts for the wealthiest people in the bluest states. There were two separate taxpayer-funded studies on diversity and inclusion in the market for marijuana. In sum, a $3 trillion wish list slapped together in a clumsy effort to never let a good crisis go to waste. Serious work here in the Senate, partisan pointlessness over in the House. Well, the Senate will stay on course and continue our serious work at this serious time. Tomorrow morning, our colleagues on the Banking Committee will hear from Secretary Mnuchin and Fed Chairman Powell on the latest status of the CARES Act implementation efforts. The Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee will meet this week to consider the nomination of Brian Miller to serve as Special Inspector General for the pandemic recovery programs. The Special Committee on Aging will be examining the challenges facing American seniors during this pandemic, as both the virus itself and the social distancing measures take a heavy toll on older Americans. And of course, we'll continue to uphold our responsibilities beyond the scope of COVID-19. We'll consider more nominations to the Federal Election Commission and the federal bench. Tomorrow, our colleagues on the Intelligence Committee will vote on reporting the nomination of John Ratcliffe to serve as Director of National Intelligence.
And, of course, we covered the Senate live on C-SPAN 2 and the hearing that the Senate Republican leader referred to that will include the Treasury Secretary and the Fed Chair. You can listen to it live here on C-SPAN Radio, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 o'clock for those of you on the West Coast. The Senate is expected to leave town Thursday afternoon, returning on June 1st. More from the Senate floor with Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York.
Now, for the third week in a row, the Republican majority in the Senate has no COVID-related business on the agenda. For the third week in a row, Leader McConnell has scheduled zero votes on legislation having to do with the crisis. Senate Democrats have had to relentlessly pressure our Republican colleagues to secure even the most routine oversight hearings on the pandemic. If we hadn't pressured them, I doubt there'd be any hearings at all, and they're few and far between. The hearings will be the only work we've done in the Senate on COVID-19 in the entire month of May, and the Republican majority had to be pressured into doing even those. There are now more than 35 million Americans out of work through no fault of their own. Almost 1.5 million Americans are sick. Nearly 90,000 have died. And Senate Republicans have decided to take the month off from the coronavirus. The American people may be wondering, what is the Republican-led Senate doing instead of addressing this urgent national crisis? What could be more pressing? What is the Republican Senate doing in the midst of the crisis? Well, Leader McConnell has scheduled 5 right-wing judges for the floor of the Senate, and the Republican chairman of the Homeland Security Committee will be holding a hearing designed to slander the family of the president's political opponent. Is the chairman of Homeland Security calling in FEMA to find out if our hospitals have enough PPE? No. He wants to echo Kremlin-backed conspiracy theories to go on a fishing expedition to smear Joe Biden's son. We all know this is what the president focuses on instead of the COVID crisis, but must our Republican colleagues gamely follow such an absurd, diversionary, and untruthful agenda? I guess so. It's a shame.
That from the Senate Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer of New York. In a Washington Post opinion piece, Greg Sargent writes about the late Friday evening firing of that State Department inspector general. Here is a portion, quote, President Trump's abrupt decision to remove the State Department IG constitutes the latest in a string of corrupt efforts to remove public servants who prioritize real oversight and accountability over protecting Trump at all costs. But in the case of Trump's termination of Steve Linnick, the State Department's IG, this could end up looking far worse than we now know. There's a backstory here that is not getting full scrutiny, one that could make the firing appear even more corrupt. House Democrats have discovered that the fired IG had mostly completed an investigation into the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, widely criticized decision to skirt Congress with an emergency declaration to approve billions of dollars in arms sales to Saudi Arabia last year, according to aides on the Foreign Affairs Committee. And he quotes the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Congressman Elliot Engel of New York, quote, I have learned that there may be another reason for Mr. Linnick's firing. His office was investigating at my request Trump's phony declaration of an emergency so he could send weapons to Saudi Arabia. The full essay at WashingtonPost.com. With reaction at the White House, here's the president.
Explain, sir, why you decided to fire the inspector general at the State Department.
I don't know him at all. I never even heard of him. But I was asked to by the State Department, by Mike. I offered most of my people, almost all of them, I said, you know, these are Obama appointees, and if you'd like to let him go, I think you should let him go, but that's up to you. He's an Obama employee. I understand he had a lot of problems with the DOD. There was an investigation on him, on the inspector general. I don't know anything about it. So I don't know him, never heard of him, but they asked me to terminate him. I have the absolute right as president to terminate. I said, who appointed him? And they said, President Obama. I said, look, I'll terminate him. I don't know what's going on other than that, but you'd have to ask Mike Pompeo. Yeah. But they did ask me to do it, and I did it. I have the right to terminate the inspector generals. I would have suggested, and I did suggest in pretty much all cases, you get rid of the attorney generals because it happens to be very political, whether you like it or not. And many of these people were Obama appointments. And so I just got rid of them.
And you've got some criticism from Democrats in Congress who are saying this is a pattern of you trying to avoid having accountability.
And if I didn't fire them, they would have criticized me, too. They'd criticize no matter what you do. You know, if you have too many ventilators, they'll say, gee, he has too many ventilators. If you don't have enough, they'll say he doesn't have enough. No matter what you do, between that and their partner, the fake news media, they'll find something. No, I don't know the gentleman. I was happy to do it. Mike requested that I do it. He should have done it a long time ago, in my opinion. He's an Obama appointment, and he had some difficulty. But I just don't know who he is. I don't know. I never heard his name.
Do you believe there is a role for inspector generals to keep an administration like yours or anyone else as accountable?
Sure, but I think they have to be fair. And I think it's a death wish when you — and I told my people, I said, I think you should you know, study your situation, but let us know. I think we've been treated very unfairly by inspector generals. I can go into instances, but I'm not going to do it now. But the inspector generals, when they're put in by Obama, just like it could be that if they were put in by me and it was somebody else's administration, especially the other party, it could very well be that you'd be treated unfairly. But we've had a lot of cases where we thought that was unfair. Asked me to do that. I think the big thing is that they should have asked me to do it a long time ago.
The president with Reuters White House correspondent Jeff Mason and the firing of Stephen Linnick, the U.S. attorney who served as the inspector general in the State Department. The headline from The Washington Post, Trump's purge just got much more corrupt, and ABC News reporting that the inspector general was in fact investigating the president's emergency arms sales to Saudi Arabia. It's the latest in a series of developments that could end up hurting the president in his reelection this year. The headline at Politico.com, swing state Republicans warning the Trump campaign. The campaign is on shaky ground. We talked to Alex Eisenstadt late this afternoon.
Well, it's interesting. We talked to an array of senior Republicans, from former governors, former state legislative leaders, and current and former party officials, really in the swing states that are going to decide this election. And what we found was pretty uniform, which is that there is a lot of apprehension about Donald Trump's reelection prospects right now. And a lot of it has to do with his management of the coronavirus. And one theme that I kind of ran across was that, Trump wants to ensure that this election is not simply a referendum on his presidency, an up or down vote on his presidency. He's trying to ensure that this is a choice election. And so he is trying to damage Joe Biden. He is trying to raise concerns about Biden on a host of issues. But talking to folks in these states, what they're saying is that, look, this is going to be a referendum on Trump's presidency. For all that Trump tries to make this about Biden, this is going to be an up or down vote on his presidency, and most particularly his handling of the coronavirus, which, of course, is likely to be the defining issue of the 2020 calendar year.
And it sounds an awful lot like the playbook of 2016 against Hillary Clinton. But based on the reporting this morning in The Washington Post, the Biden campaign is not going to respond to every tweet, every comment from Trump and his campaign trying to be above it all.
Yeah, they're trying to sort of keep an above it all approach. What's interesting, though, is that the Trump campaign, as his poll numbers have sagged in a variety of states, everywhere from Michigan to Florida, we've seen Trump launch this really aggressive effort to damage Biden, and it's run the gamut from issues like China to even, and we saw Don Jr., and this is just shows just how ugly this campaign is going to get. Don Jr., the president's son, did a social media post over the weekend suggesting that there's some kind of connection between Biden and pedophilia. Look, it's only May. And that just tells you just how ugly this campaign is going to get by the time we get to fall.
And yet, as you know, Don Trump Jr. said it was just a joke. He was only kidding.
That's right. And it's interesting because, this is the kind of campaign tactic that it'd be hard to imagine being used in campaigns of 12, 15, 20 years ago. But this is where the Trump campaign is willing to go as he pursues reelection.
So as you look at the states that really will matter for Democrats and Republicans, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, North Carolina, what's the standing of the Trump campaign? What are the governors or former governors in those states telling you?
What's interesting is that you look across all these states and the president, at least in public polling, seems to be behind in almost all of them. So talking, for example, with former Governor Tommy Thompson of Wisconsin, what he's saying is, look, for Trump to come back and win Wisconsin the way he did in 2016, he's going to have to make a lot of visits to Wisconsin. Now, that, of course, could be complicated by the coronavirus, but we have seen Trump making some visits to swing states. He's going to Michigan this week. He's going to Pennsylvania this week. But one of the problems that Trump is having in some of these states are he is losing the support of senior voters, who, of course, play a key role in his 2016 win. And you take this in Georgia and you take this in Pennsylvania. he's lost a lot of the support of suburban voters, particularly suburban women. And so those are some real challenges that people are warning that he's going to have to take really seriously over the course of this year.
Attacking Joe Biden will only get the president so far, writes Alex Eisenstadt. Ultimately, the election will be a referendum on the president. Joining us here in Washington, the story at Politico.com. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And finally, a quick update on the states and COVID-19. In Richmond earlier today, Governor Ralph Northam announcing that Virginia Beach will reopen this Friday. But with requirements on social distancing, new rules will be in place to prevent the type of crowd seen on other beaches, especially in states like Florida and Texas. Tents and umbrellas for large groups will be prohibited, along with playing sports like volleyball, football, and frisbee. Parking garages and surface parking near Virginia Beach will be limited to 50% capacity. And in upstate New York, parts of the western part of New York, including Buffalo and Rochester, will see businesses opening their doors again, beginning tomorrow with restrictions. And in Texas, bars will be allowed to reopen this Friday in advance of Memorial Day weekend. Bowling alleys, bingo halls, zoos, and aquariums also will be open, but those businesses must be open at only 25% capacity. A reminder, all of our coverage is available on the web at cspan.org/coronavirus. And this program, Washington Today, is available as a podcast. You can also find it on the web at cspan.org/podcasts. I'm Steve Scully in our nation's capital. Enjoy the rest of your Monday evening.